Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to the fourth newly recorded episode of Free Forum in 2017. I'm going to be joined today by Chip Berlet, who spent over 40 years studying prejudice, demonization, scapegoating, demagoguery, conspiracies, and authoritarianism. After hosting and producing the show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews in 2014, and since then I've dug into the archives to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts with years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring the path forward in confronting him and his administration, and thus these new interviews. On Free Forum, we've always explored the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. So first off today, I'm going to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in the resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. Email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, and you can get these websites and more. Indivisibleguide.com, indivisibleguide.com, ourrevolution.com, that's one word again, Our Revolution. That's the organization started by the Sanders campaign. Couragecampaign.org. Courage Campaign is a California organization and a very good and effective progressive organization. And one thing they've told me is that where they used to emphasize online activism, they now are making a very concerted effort to link online activism to grassroots activism on the streets and in neighborhoods. MoveOn.org, national organization, saying the same thing, linking their online activism to progressive actions on the ground. Fivecalls.org, the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, that is kind of what it sounds like. They will keep supplying you with the critical phone calls you need to make to affect legislation as it attempts to make its way through Congress. And obviously, we've had some success with that so far. And then townhallproject.com, townhallproject.com. And that keeps you informed about when your representatives from Washington are holding town halls when they're back at home. And as we know, one of the things that worked very well for the Tea Party and seems to be working well for progressives is showing up and letting them know that there are constituents who are watching what they do. Okay? So now, let me quote from an article in The Nation by Michelle Chen, and Donald Trump's rise has coincided with an explosion of hate groups, is the title of the article. And here's the quote. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center's annual census of extremist groups, the number of hate groups in the United States rose for a second year in a row in 2016 as the radical right was energized by the candidacy of Donald Trump. The number of explicitly anti-Muslim groups has nearly tripled since 2015 alone to over 100 nationwide. There's also been a spike in reported incidents of hate violence, including harassment and physical assault, alongside rising anti-Muslim hostile behavior and bullying in schools. Of nearly 1,100 bias incidents that the Southern Poverty Law Center reports, 37% of them directly referenced either President-elect Trump, his campaign slogans, or his infamous remarks about sexual assault. Do you hear that? Of nearly 1,100 incidents, 37 directly referenced some reference to Trump or his statements or actions. And according to the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, state data on anti-Muslim hate crimes indicate a spate of crimes across North America, including physical assaults, vandalism, phone threats. In the 5 days that followed in the wake of Trump's December 7th, 2015 speech, calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on in response to the San Bernardino terrorist attacks. So a huge spike. Chip Berlet my guest for the next hour, has investigated far-right hate groups, reactionary backlash movements, theocratic fundamentalism, civil liberties violations, police misconduct, government and private surveillance abuse, and other anti-democratic phenomena. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, Mother Jones, and The Nation. He's co-author with Matthew Lyons of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. Welcome, Chip Berlet, to Free Forum.
Oh, thanks to have me on, and it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Chip and I have been friends for years and fellow panelists at conferences, and I believe this may be the first time we've ever done this via the radio. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us briefly about your path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Wow. Well, I'd say getting involved in the civil rights movement and working up until the point when Martin Luther King was killed, and then saying to myself, "Nation in his honor over his assassination in Newark," when my parents said, "If you go to Newark, you'll be killed by them.
by them.
If you go, don't bother coming home." And I went anyway. I didn't help that I told them that I would be safe because the Black Panther Party was guaranteeing our safety. But I got home and they took me back in, and it sort of taught me that sometimes you have to do things that may cause a strain in your relationship. So, you know, just from there, stepped through into doing journalism. I actually went to college at the University of Denver and knew Condoleezza Rice's father as Dean John Rice, and he put me in his class called The Black Experience in America. And I just started to realize there were institutional and systemic problems that often weren't talked about, and I think that's what set me on the path that I followed since then.
Okay. And I also noticed in looking at your bio, you spent some time writing for High Times as well.
It's true.
And so that was, you were doing that at the same time, and, you know, that was...
That was a bunch of years later. I had gotten involved in the underground press, and, I inhaled and basically got to know the guy who founded High Times. We were in the Zippies together. We put the Zip back into the Yippies. We
mm-hmm.
were the splinter group. So, you know, it just seemed really natural, and I worked in Washington as their Washington correspondent. Of course, the problem is I'd go to New York for conferences, and they'd forget, you know, when I got back to Washington, you know, "Oh, wow, did we assign this? Oh, this is interesting." You know, it was difficult in going to New York and talking to them. They had, for instance, you know, tray is full of joints, and the entire office was piped with nitrous oxide tanks, so...
But, you know, one thing, when I first thought about it, I thought, "Oh, that's a quirky diversion." But as we know, the war on drugs, as in all of its, the late Mike Gray points out that in all its manifestations has always been ethnic or racist prejudice. And the mass incarceration in the United States, which is such a lethal and under-dealt with problem, is absolutely linked to the war on drugs.
Right. It goes all the way back to the FBI COINTELPRO programs and, you know, the kind of spying but also disruption of black groups, socialist communist groups, anti-war groups, civil rights groups, you know, and that's a story that came out through investigative journalism. So investigative journalism has uncovered a lot of this stuff, whether it's civil liberties repression or the kind of racist and more recently homophobic as gay people came out and now anti-Semitic and Islamophobic forces within the presidential cadre.
Mm-hmm. So as I was preparing for this interview, and I've already given two lists, one when I first mentioned your name, once when I was doing your bio. But I noted that we would likely talk about some mix of populism, fascism, authoritarianism, racism, white nationalism, hate crimes, and so on. Do you, when you think about this yourself, and this is your, you know, this is your arena, this is your space, Is there one word, one expression that sort of holds these together for you, or a thread?
Sure. The word would be authoritarianism. And the idea that everyone has to conform to your view of what's appropriate.
Okay, so in other words, all those others kind of, for you, sort of spin out of that as a core principle.
Sure, you know, your identity is the only proper identity. And, you know, you look at Trump and his rhetoric throughout the campaign, you know, he made assumptions to the audiences to which he spoke about what was the proper American citizen. And he left out Mexicans and people who support women's rights and the rights to reproductive justice, to, you know, Muslims and pretty much anyone who would challenge, you know, his ego, which he has essentially decided is what's best for America.
Right. In other words, and one of the things when I hear his America First rhetoric is it's almost like he's translated his individual narcissism to a national narcissism.
Right, and this is not the first time that's happened in terms of world leaders, is it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we'll call the bundle of things authoritarianism. So in terms of that authoritarianism in American society, let me give you a chance to tell us some of the history. How did we get here? What is the history? What are the trends? As far as I can tell, of course, this has been a constant in American society. Just to set that up for a second, we know that Donald Trump chose to visit the home or the grave of Andrew Jackson, who, of course, was an earlier strain of the same kind of authoritarianism in office. So tell us some of the history.
So let's look at Andrew Jackson to start with. He was a populist. He is often portrayed by earlier writers who looked at this period as a great common man kind of leader and was great for America. Well, and that's true unless you were a Cherokee Indian, because he pretty much managed to kill off most of the Cherokee Nation by forcing them on a death march out west to open up land for white farmers and settlers. So we look at that and the position of really setting up the idea of right-wing populism or populist authoritarianism in America is traceable back to Andrew Jackson. So we're looking then at a nation in which, and I know a lot of people are going to be offended by this, but it was basically white Christian patriarchal settlers from Europe who basically decided, they were built around ideas of white superiority and Christian superiority. They murdered tens of thousands of indigenous people through direct conflict and through disease. They brought in black Africans and slaves. And for centuries now, there's been a struggle, the struggle we're facing now, of what is the core identity of our nation? Is it, in fact, a pluralist democratic society built on democracy? Or is it, in fact, the homeland of a certain kind of racial, ethnic, religious group, and that if you're not part of that group or willing to act just like people in that group, you don't belong here. You're not really appropriate material for being a citizen.
Right. It's what does it mean in different decades and different eras when we say we the people? Who are those people? And in some sense, let me check this one with you. There have been moments when it didn't matter even if you were white. If you were the newest arrivals, you were discriminated against, whether that's the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, etc. Correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And so there's a great book about, you know, how the Irish became white, which looked at the fact that for many years, as European groups that were considered unsavory by the English and German early settlers, there was tremendous hostility and prejudice and discrimination, and even people were killed for being the wrong type of person. And we forget that at our own peril, because this is the struggle we're in now. You know, who is the proper citizen? And so many white people who are now considered part of the in-group by the Trump people were very much part of the out-group in earlier decades.
Yeah, exactly. I spent some of my youth in Boston, and in the middle 60s, there was, of course, anti-black prejudice, but the fights between the Italians from one part of town and the Irish from another part of town were something I had never seen growing up in the South.
Right, that's true. And that goes back to how traditionally power elites have set people against each other based on their ethnicity or religion or race that's perceived. And that is then used so that you reward one group as the dominant group, but that requires them to continue to step on the heads of the unsavory group, the people defined as not proper citizenship material.
So there we've talked about racial prejudice, but and you just kind of, in that transition we just made, you mentioned it's elites pitting any group. So this populism, which we ascribe to Jackson as sort of the first small D Democrat, what is populism, and how has that thread run through the state, through the U.S.?
Well, absolutely, because populism, really, most people know of it as the People's Party, which was a mass movement across the nation that was populist but progressive and really sought reforms in terms of economic and political structures that were very, very good. So populism is basically a form of mobilizing people against corrupt elites who are not representing the interests of the people, however they're defined. And that can be good or bad. It can move to the left or right. We used to think, and most scholars used to think, that populism was essentially a good movement, or at least a movement that thought of itself as good, although in the 1960s, with the student and women's and anti-war revolts, there was a whole bunch of literature that came out that populism was always, you know, a threat to democracy. But in 1980, this writer named Margaret Canavan wrote this whole study that said, look, populism goes off in different directions on many different avenues, and you really have to look at it in the context in which it's mobilizing. And so she sort of set everything on its head in terms of populism research, and then a guy named Michael Kazin came along and wrote a really good book just talking about populism in America and how it was framed as a kind of rhetorical style to mobilize people into political and social action. And that's where we are now, I think, in scholarship. I mean, I think some of the best scholarship now, people like Cass Muda and others, recognize that populism is very complicated, and we can have populism being mobilized by Trump to, you know, basically beat up on Muslims and Mexicans and feminists and anyone he doesn't like or can't grab. And yet we can also have populist movements around groups like Move On or any of the websites you mentioned, which I knew some of, but I don't know all of them. I'm going to go back and check them out. They sound great.
Okay. Let me read you a quote of yours. Trump supporters make up the classic right-wing populist constituency, the same kind of people who populated the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and who voted for Hitler in the late Weimar period of the 1930s Germany. That's that thread we're talking about, right?
That's correct.
And so it's when you set up you set yourself up as somehow between the people and the elites.
Well, you know, populism is when people mobilize as a group of people who are being maltreated, and they rail against the corrupt elites. And those corrupt elites can be real or a conspiracy theory. You could have people who work within democratic civil society to achieve change and kick the corrupt elites out. Or you can have people who basically, you know, bring down the government. And around the world, you see in Europe now, much of the anger at the impoverishment of the entire bottom 90% of the citizenry in countries across Europe and in the United States, there's real anger about this kind of greedster neoliberal economic system, and people are mad. Now, they can be mad and decide to build democracy, or they can be mad and blame the round up the usual suspects for the right, the foreigner, the gender rebel, the people who don't speak the language, whatever. It's easy to find a scapegoat. It's a time-honored tradition.
Right, and you quote Umberto Eco in some articles, and this is Eco, and you can tell me when he said this. There is in our future a TV or internet populism in which the emotional response of a selected group of citizens can be presented and accepted as the voice of the people. Wherever a politician casts doubt on the legitimacy of a parliament because it no longer represents the voice of the people, we can smell fascism.
Umberto Eco, who is a really well-known academic from Italy, wrote Eternal Fascism, 14 Ways of Looking at a Black Shirt. And a lot of people have copied similar headings, but this is, appeared in the New York Review of Books in 1995. So
okay.
It was, you know, after the internet was
yeah.
built, but it...
But yeah. I mean, to me, I mean, in 95, and especially from someone looking at us from abroad, that's pretty prescient, I think. And
oh, no, it was way, yeah. Umberto Eco's essay was way ahead of its time and came out of his study of apocalyptic thinking, of, you know, basically the dividing of the world into the bad times, which are about to be replaced by a transformation of gigantic proportions, which is the basis of many world religions. But, you know, apocalypticism can move in a very progressive way in terms of, you know, revolting against unfairness, but it also can turn into a hunt for the agents of Satan, which so much of the Christian right is obsessed with. So yeah, basically it was saying what a lot of, you know, scholars since even before the fall of Hitler were saying, which is that these kinds of movements are apocalyptic. They're millenarian. They're basically it's a version of bad apocalyptic forms, which look for the subversive, traitorous, evil people who are destroying the nation, which is exactly what Trump's basic whole campaign was built around.
And absolutely.
There's a conspiracy. There's a conspiracy. A conspiracy of liberals and Mexicans and immigrants and gay people against all of us.
Hey, and feminists.
And feminists, God knows.
Yeah.
You know, and all those people who don't eat the right food and don't want me grabbing women, whatever.
That's right.
And you get the idea.
And I would add even college students and colleges. You know, anyone who... So what we're doing right now, Chip, is we're spending a little time with the folks who are the audience for Trump, the audience for
sure.
the populist. And Arlie Hochschild in Strangers in Their Own Land, right? Where she spent years talking to the disconnected, the dispossessed, the unemployed, the unhealthy in the surrounding the Petro Bayou, if you will, of Louisiana. And her premise is that all political belief is undergirded by emotion. And she writes that given the experiences that those folks have undergone, there's a deep story. And this is a collectively shared narrative about what feels true. And the deep story of the Tea Party, she says, is that the American dream has leveled off. 90% of Americans between 1980 and 2012 received no rise in salary, while dividends from a rising GDP rose dramatically for the top 10%. And that has not changed at all, I would say, you know, maybe there's rounding errors, but hardly changed at all in the 8 years of Obama. So you have a black president and those who feel left out feel like he did nothing for them, and this is the audience to which Trump was speaking. What I think you point out, as so many do at this point, really, is that they have legitimate grievances. That emotion he tapped came from legitimate grievance.
That's absolutely right. And I actually got in touch with Harley Hochschild before the book came out to check to see if she was on the same thread, and she had already beat me to it with all of her work in Louisiana. So yeah, half of their analysis is right. Their solution is what's wrong. And the only way you can distract people from a solution of demanding fair economy and better treatment is to distract them with a conspiracy theory and a set of evil, subversive, lazy, whatever, others. And, you know, that goes back to Reagan blaming welfare mothers for the economic problems, which was, you know, just another myth based on a racist set of assumptions. So we're now battling over that narrative. And you and I both agree that narratives are really important. And one of the narratives that's so powerful is when you tell someone they're being held down by this conspiracy. They and there's a bunch of writers who have written about the sense of being displaced or shoved aside, or people shoving ahead of them in line, as Arlie Hochschild talks about. You know, that these people paid their dues, they bought into the American dream, they worked hard, and the promise was they could retire and go fishing in the bayou, and their kids would have better jobs and a better life. Those people got screwed. Most Americans got screwed, while a handful of billionaires picked their pockets so they could buy a bigger yacht. And you wonder why people are pissed off? Of course they are.
Right. And so for those who've listened to the show over the years, this will be old hat, but what I always sort of look at is that I believe it was with the advent of television advertising as the primary way of driving campaigns, campaigns became much more expensive. And the problem this created for Democrats, I think, came to full focus in under Clinton. And he finally said, well, we're going to raise our money from the same people the Republicans raise their money from. And that's the neoliberals. That's the neoliberal message. That's the new Democrats, the LDC, the Democratic leadership thing. And what they did, once both sides are raising their money from the same people, the Wall Street billionaires and the multinational corporations, then the fact that the Republicans actually share the ideals and the platform of their funders, while the Democrats give lip service to the fact that those are not their principles, that they have other principles, you can look at that and guess who has an advantage in that contest. It's the one.
Absolutely.
It's the one that.
You're totally right.
Yeah. It's the one that does exactly what their funders want and can speak with full-throated, you know, assurance and, as I say, can go for touchdowns, while the Democrats are willing to stop at the 20-yard line because they don't want to offend some of their funders. I think that's the political reality that has led to the ability for these people to be left out, feel left out, and be preyed upon because they are left out.
That's right.
So let me
look. I always say, look, it's like the Republicans want to just kill you, and the Democrats want to just cut off your arm.
Yeah. Yeah, although neither one of them would say that, so
obviously it's a little hyperbole.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the Democrats will say we care about the little guy, and then when they have a chance to nominate someone who actually cares about the little guy, they don't do it.
Right.
You know, so in that Nation article that I quoted before from Michelle Chen about the rise of hate crimes, she asks a question, which I'm going to ask you: is the rage-fueled racial invective Trump stokes on stage actually driving violence on the ground? Or is it just a symptom of years of intensifying hostility towards those scapegoated races and scapegoated ethnicities, Muslims and blacks and immigrants? And what should Muslim and immigrant communities do when the political establishment stakes its claim to power on a culture of hate? So is this Trump, or is it years finally bubbling over? My guess is it's both.
Well, it's both, and I just traded messages with Michelle Chen to make sure that's what she was saying. It was a brilliant article, and it's basically, it's important to look at the milieu and then understand the idea that when a group is demonized and scapegoated enough, that over time it's virtually inevitable that someone will say, well, if they're so bad and they're out to get us, why don't we get them first?
Yes.
So I wrote a couple of years ago when editors kept telling me that the idea that rhetoric could cause any form of violence was just a liberal myth, I wrote a scholarly article called Heroes Know Which Villains to Kill. Because heroes know which villains to kill, because somebody is framing rhetoric and narratives to suggest that it is an existential threat to the society, to the nation, caused by a specific named group of people who become scapegoats. And that over time, it is inevitable that someone will say they don't deserve to live. Or we should go stomp them. And that has happened repeatedly throughout history. And people need to know that that is how it works. You pick a scapegoat, you demonize the scapegoat, you say that they're threatening everything you hold dear as a nation and your family, and then they sit back without any direct link and watch as people get hurt, stomped, beaten, and killed.
Yeah, it's the idea that I have to, for the good of my country, for the good of my community, for the good of all I hold dear, I better get them first.
We got to get them first.
Yeah, yeah. So we've talked about the historical threads to which Trump kind of is the present manifestation. What do you think the 2016 election means in terms of the things we've been talking about, scapegoating, authoritarianism, violence within society, and so on? What do you take? We're now, you know, enough months away. What do you take that the 2016 election means?
Well, it's pretty horrifying to me, but I think it means that there is a limited ability to solve the problem without rearranging the economic system drastically. This is not a thought that I came up with. Obviously, Bernie Sanders talked about it, and it really resonated. And it was the failure of Hillary Clinton to talk about actual economic fairness and reform that I think led people who knew better to vote for Trump. I went out to San Antonio before the election to do a speech, and I hang out as a journalist, and I struck up conversations with people, you know, and say, so what do you think? And I heard time and time again is, you know, I don't like Hillary, I don't like Trump, but I'm thinking maybe a vote for Trump is going to send a message, or they said in more kind of common language, you know, that it would get rid of, it would just shake things up. They didn't use the word shake. And I talked to people in three or four different cities who said the same thing, that, you know, it's time to shake things up. It's time to throw a monkey wrench at the government. They're not listening to us. And, you know, I actually made a bet with another radio person a couple of weeks before the election that Trump would win, because I was hoping it wasn't true, but I was beginning to hear people who didn't want to admit publicly they were going to vote for Trump say that it was time to just mess things up in Washington because anything would be better than what we have. Well, it turns out it's not, because Trump is, you know, I think he uses fascistic rhetoric, but he himself lacks the intelligence to be an actual fascist. But he has created the potential for a mass fascist base in America by creating the list of scapegoats. And that's what Michelle is saying, is that when you create a list of scapegoats and you're president, violence is inevitable. So I think we're at the Weimar moment, which, you know, back in 2010, I had a lunch conversation with Noam Chomsky with a couple of other folks saying, you know, is this the Weimar moment? Are we starting to see the unraveling of democratic civil society in a way that could go bad very quickly? And he was, you know, way out front in talking about this. And there's a great essay by a professor bookbinder who studies the Weimar period. It's on a website called Facing History and Ourselves. And it's called The Fragility of Democracy, that right before Hitler gained power, there were chances to stop his rise to power that people didn't take. And so I interviewed Professor Bookbinder saying, well, do you see any echoes of Weimar and Hitler and Trump? And I thought he was going to sort of dance around the subject. And he said, oh, yes, I do. And he then explained them to me. And it was really, it scared me that here was a leading scholar on the Weimar period prior to Hitler's rise to power saying, yeah, we're in that moment where things could still go either way. That's the moment that was created when Trump was elected.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read a quote from something you'd written specifically about this. The Weimar period is crucial to understand because it was that precise moment in Germany's history when a broad united front crossing traditional political boundaries to defend democracy could have blocked the mass base of a right-wing populist. So that's where he thinks we are, and that was, as you say, a couple of years ago, that's where you think we are. If that's kind of the point we are, what's your best take on our best bet? As those who are going to head this off?
Well, I've spent a lot of time doing activist work in neighborhoods and with labor unions, and you need to learn to listen to people, listen to their stories, right? Yeah, before you lecture them about what you think. You should never lecture people about what you think. You want to have a conversation about what they think and what you think, and then how you can work together. So don't just write a check and send it someplace. It's time to really talk to your neighbors, talk to your coworkers, listen to their concerns, and seek that common ground. Because, and this has got to be done on the local level, just with people that you can talk to face to face. And my advice, is for this kind of defense of democracy, because we're defending democracy itself, is be strong, have each other's backs, defend every target of demonizing right-wing rhetoric threatening our allies, our neighbors, and our friends. Anyone facing repression or oppression or attack, leave no one behind. It's like the movie Lifeboat by Hitchcock. You're not even supposed to throw the Nazi overboard during World War II from your lifeboat. Everyone is not going to be thrown under the bus or off the lifeboat. Build a society where no one is thrown under the bus or out of the lifeboat. That's the easiest thing to remember. And then, it's pretty terrible right now. Take time for yourself and those close to you. Let the next generation grow into leaders. Don't always be the one talking in the meeting. And pass it forward so that the circle remains unbroken. Defending democracy has a long historic trail, and we need to get on it and march forward.
One thing I wanted to double back, I had taken a note that I forgot to mention, which was earlier in the conversation when we were saying that thing of that if you convince people that someone, some scapegoat is out to get them, is out to end their society, et cetera, they will pick up on it and there will be violence. And in an article by Deborah Caldwell, that you referenced in my research, she pointed out that in Rwanda, prior to the genocide, a private radio station tried to instill fear of an imminent attack on Hutus by a Tutsi militia. In the months before the conflicts in Serbia, state television attempted to create the impression that a World War II-style ethnic cleansing initiative against Serbs was in the work. And throughout the 1990s, Georgian media outlets sought to portray ethnic minorities as threat to Georgia's hard-won independence. And in every one of those cases, the people took up the torch, took up the machete, took up the gun, and acted in response to that sown fear.
And that scared me when I read that research. There are two authors who were very obscure but nailed it. It's online. Embedded in my article, Heroes Know Which Villains to Kill. And I'm not suggesting this is my idea. All I did was synthesize it and try and remind people about it. So it's very important to recognize that it's going on now, that people are being hurt because of this rhetoric. And, if you look for a direct link between Trump's rhetoric and the people being hurt and killed, you're not going to find it. But if you do social science research, you're going to see the explanation, an explanation that was discussed by Hannah Arendt early on after World War II and the Nazi genocide.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to two specific little things I came across. One was in an article in the Columbia Journalism Review about the fact that BuzzFeed got criticism from other media outlets for publishing the Trump-Russia dossier. This is the dossier from the Brit who had been involved in intelligence, and it's the one that got a lot of publicity. And it was clear that the intelligence services were investigating it, and as we know from Comey's testimony, are investigating these same things, whether because of the dossier or not. But BuzzFeed chose to publish the dossier and got criticism from much of the mainstream press. You were quoted as saying, denouncing people to your flank to justify your own credentials is a tactic which is old and proven disastrous. That never ends well as the knife keeps cutting the sausage. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, it goes back to people who are trying to get in a position of being accepted by the leaders who they're trying to criticize. And I go back to some of my mentors. I'm old enough now to have actually spent time talking to I.O. Stone and an earlier muckraker named George Seldes. Always these people are isolated throughout history, going all the way back to the earliest press operators in the colonies. If you take on the status quo and the power elites, there will be sanctions. And some of those sanctions are that the people who want to keep those ties open denounce you as a troublemaker, as someone who has done something unethical or outside the fold of respectable journalism.
Yeah, you went too far.
They're going to say, you went too far, but we're not going to. And you know, as soon as you've isolated those people, you're next in line.
Yeah.
That's what we learned from the McCarthy period until somebody finally stood up and said, this is bogus. All of this is a steaming pile of doo-doo.
Yeah.
And of course, the whole thing unraveled in a matter of months after that, with the McCarthy hearings and Edward R. Murrow being the person who finally said, have you no shame, essentially quoting the person who confronted the McCarthy hearings.
Yeah. And let's for anyone who hasn't come across this, one of McCarthy's young, bright, shining henchmen was Roy Cohn. And there is probably no mentor. If you read The Art of the Deal or anything else about Donald Trump, there's probably no mentor who has meant more to him than that same principle-less,
Then you're saying that Roy Cohn was a snake, and most decent people know that. And I'll point out that the person being challenged, which finally broke the back of the McCarthy period, was a young lawyer who had been a member of the National Lawyers Guild, which is to the left of the ACLU, and they wanted to tie him to a stake and burn him in the hearings. And finally, his attorney said, have you no shame?
Yeah.
You know, this is just a kid who is in a group, and you're trying to pillory him in front of a television audience.
But I mean, when you see Trump, I'm just pressing that connection to Roy Cohn as his mentor. When you see Trump accused of something, he will almost always do two things: one, change the subject; two, accuse back.
Right.
And that is classic. That is classic Cohn. And in fact, Cohn's message also includes never admit wrong, never apologize. And I think one thing we see is that, to my observation, is that Trump follows this now. So whether it's the wiretap or the birther accusation, whatever it is, he follows that, and he will never admit wrong, and he will never do that. And I think perhaps that the audience that agrees with him, the ones who are absolutely for him standing up to, you know, the mainstream press and so on, that's wonderful. That's him being a tough guy. But I do suspect that inability to ever admit wrong is shrinking his followers.
Absolutely. I think that more and more people are realizing that they've been screwed, and that they were conned into voting for someone who was just telling them, in some cases, what they wanted to hear and had no intention of doing anything except, you know, imposing a kind of authoritarian form of economic segregation so that there are billionaires and the rest of us.
I suspect if you're going too far to think that there are lots of people who actually see that. What I'm thinking is they saw, wait a minute, this deal that he's backing would take 24 million off. Wait a minute, but then I think, you know, one of the other things that's going to cost him is his number one claim was, I'm the super negotiator. I'm the king of the deal. And we have seldom seen a deal fall apart more rudely and more obviously than last week with the health care bill.
Oh, that's going to be interesting to watch him try and work that out, because most people in healthcare know that the bill the phantom bill he's proposing is absolutely unworkable. And even if he could figure it out, it would take 2 to 3 years to implement because of the existing channels of funding.
But I mean, when you say this is my biggest strength, and it turns out you've left yourself open, you know, you've taken on a big one early, you've taken it on rushed, you've taken it on ill-prepared, you've taken it on ununited, you've et cetera, et cetera. This is going to cause some doubt. Let me go to another specific. In early March, Trump reportedly told state attorneys general that the recent wave of anti-Semitic threats and attacks, which we've seen, there have been calls, people calling in threats to synagogues, threats, et cetera, not just to mosques, right? We knew they were threatening mosques, but they also have been threatening synagogues and Jewish establishments, that the recent wave of anti-Semitic threats and attacks may be somehow faked and intended to besmirch him and his movement. Threats are not genuine, he suggested. They are the reverse. This is a quote. They are the reverse, he said, carried out by his political opponents to make people or to make others look bad. Now, he's following the lead there of former Ku Klux Klan head David Duke, who tweeted, President Trump, do you think it might be the Jews themselves making these calls to get sympathy to push their ethnic agenda? Duke tweets it. Trump says it. This is out there for me. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I tell you, that's a classic Hitlerian period ploy. Blame the Jews, blame violence on the Jews, blame violence on the communists, burn down the Reichstag. You know, basically, what you have here is Trump was elected with a very broad coalition, which ranged from the Christian right and white nationalists and Republicans who could stomach him, out to neo-fascists and actual neo-Nazis, especially involved with alt-right and Banyan's umbrella network of groups that believe in white racial nationalism. And basically, it's you have targeted people, but you also have brought people out publicly because they sense that this is the time to settle scores. And remember that, you know, you have Trump talking about the international banks being the problem. Well, if you're a farmer in Oregon, you might say, yeah, Wall Street. But if you're a fascist or a neo-Nazi, you're going to say Jewish bankers.
Absolutely.
So that's the dog whistle that Trump uses and his people use.
Let me just ask you for a fact, just that we haven't covered. No, I meant this is one specific, which is that Trump is still trying to impose a Muslim travel ban. We'll see where this one goes. What is the reality in terms of ethnic violence in America, the comparative role of Islamic-related terrorism versus homegrown white terrorism?
Homegrown right-wing white terrorism is the biggest threat to American security, and it outflanks even the most militant, awful Islamic-oriented terrorist, because so many people who practice Islam in the United States denounce the violence by this handful of people who claim Islam as an excuse.
Dylann Roof, the young white supremacist who killed the blacks in the church in Charleston, his website was The Last Rhodesian. Explain to people what that means.
In Africa, as the black majority began to rebel against the control of white settlers, Rhodesia and South Africa and several other countries became a symbol for defense by groups like the John Birch Society, but more so by groups that were outright fascist and neo-Nazi. I would point out that you know, this was not just something hidden in the corners. This was publicly debated in the 1960s about the need to defend Rhodesia and South Africa from communist rule. And the excuse was, well, you know, the blacks may be the majority, but they're manipulated by the sneaky communists. And so basically that's the storyline, was that Rhodesia is an emblem of the need to defend white minority rule against those evil, butchering blacks.
Okay.
And I might point out that that church, by the way, you know, Dylann Roof had hooked into the alt-right network, but he also chose a church in Charleston, Mother Emanuel, that had been a center of slave resistance in the South, and really it was singled out because of that. It was a place where blacks tried to build resistance to the white slavocracy.
Yeah, it was not just any black church.
Exactly.
Anything you want to add to what people might know at this point about Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller?
Well, I think it's important to know that alt-right is not a social movement or a political movement. It's a media-savvy umbrella group of a lot of tendencies that were brought into the Trump campaign for several reasons, one of which is all of the dog whistles that were coming out of the Trump campaign were aimed at these groups affiliated with alt-right. But at the same time, Bannon was affiliated with a group that Trump had hired to send out anonymous covert messages to people through social media telling them to not vote for Hillary.
Mm-hmm. And we've got about 4 minutes left. What would you want people to take from this conversation or from your work in terms of this moment?
That this kind of violence is not random. It's not unprovoked. It is structured. There's a history of demonizing the other that goes back and in Western culture arises in Europe in the Middle Ages with the attacks on Jews and the pogroms that claimed that Jews were literally poisoning the wells or kidnapping children and killing them to drain their blood and make matzah, that this goes way back. Then in the new nation being built in the United States, the allegations were against the Freemasons, who were said to be run by this secret group called the Illuminati, who were doing the same old things. They were undermining the democracy, that they were subversive, that there was a giant conspiracy. And you can go throughout U.S. history at various periods. You know, in the 1800s, it was the Catholics. They were plotting against everybody. In the early 1900s, it was the Jews and the Communists had leagued together. There was even a group of people, you know, not 20 years ago, who believed that homosexuals were their a giant subversive group bringing down America, you know, and they wrote a book on the homosexual agenda. Well, you know, what was their agenda? They wanted to be treated like everyone else in terms of respect. So this is something that is structural. It is systemic. It is not something that can just be explained away by saying times are tough. When times are tough, you can either build a community together, as many groups did in the period when the Nazis were running across Europe. There were always groups of people who hid the Jews, who were joined the resistance, who basically helped their neighbors survive that period. And then there were people who turned in their neighbors, who beat up their neighbors, who shot their neighbors, who beat their neighbors with, you know, hammers until they died, as some of the pro-Nazi forces did. So this is our choice. We're either going to band together to save democracy, or democracy will collapse around us, and we'll be in grave danger, not just as a nation, but as families in streets in your own neighborhoods.
Okay, and finally, Chip Berlate, who do you read? Who do you trust? Where can listeners learn more? What are the websites, the writers and so on that you think people should pick up on?
Oddly enough, I actually decided to work with some folks and set up a website called progressivemovements.us, And it's basically, it's a finding aid for the groups that I think are doing well. And just today, I was making a bibliography of the people who I follow. Michelle Chen is certainly one of them. David Neiwert, the folks at Political Research Associates, the folks at Color Lines. The
Southern Poverty Law Center.
Southern Poverty Law Center. I've worked with them. They do excellent work. So it's basically material at progressivemovements.us is like a guide to where you can go for more information and to get active.
Okay, so I'm going to say it one more time because that .us is new to a lot of people. Progressive movements, one word, .us is where Chip and your allies are aggregating material, and so someone who wants to learn more, that would be the first stop.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's say the websites, I have two other, having just given out that one, I had two others for you. So we've got progressivemovements.us. We also have chipberlay.net, right? Is that still?
Right.
And researchforprogress.us.
I like webs. I like websites. I have many.
Yeah. So, okay. And so all three of those are places where you can learn more. And Chip's book, published in 2000, but obviously on the money today, is Right Wing Populism in America. Thank you, Chip Berlay. Keep up the good work.
Absolutely. And you too. We're all in this together, Terrence.
Absolutely. So for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net or iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. The archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, you name it. Thanks to Kiana Turner and to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely, and I look forward to being with you soon.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear on the Leslie Marshall Show weekdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network. Mr. Stan Johnson, he is the International Secretary Treasurer of the USW, the United Steelworkers Union. When you look at the record of Neil Gorsuch, you talked about corporatist, right? And you talked about him favoring corporatist. Well, this isn't just your opinion. This is facts based on his record of not standing up for working men and women, one of which is the case of a truck driver. A truck driver who was fired after nearly freezing to death in sub-zero cold temperatures in the truck cab that was unheated awaiting a mechanic. Can you speak to us about that case a bit more, Mr.
Yeah.
Johnson?
Look, this one is astounding, actually. It's so egregious. It's unbelievable that anyone would rule against this individual. This individual's truck, his trailer brakes froze up. It was like 27, I think, below zero at the time. He called into his dispatcher, as he should have done, and said, look, my trailer brakes have frozen up. I need a mechanic. The dispatcher says, fine, we'll get you someone out there in an hour. Number one, he shouldn't have been driving a truck without a heater that was working. That should have been resolved far before he got out in 27 below temperatures by the company, but it wasn't. So he crawls up in the back of his truck, bundles up in whatever he could find to bundle up in to try to stay warm, maybe up to 16 below inside the cab of the truck. He goes to sleep. He gets a phone call from a relative, wakes him up. It's been 2.5 hours. He is now suffering symptoms of hypothermia, turning blue, a bit confused. He gets on the radio, calls the dispatcher again and says, look, no one's here. I'm freezing to death. Something's got to be done. He said, I can't stay out here. They essentially said, you either stay out there or you drag the trailer with trailer brakes frozen to the next stop. So Mr. Madden had two choices at that point. He either endangers his own life by staying out there in sub-zero temperatures, or he endangers the public safety by pulling a trailer onto the road with the trailer brakes locked and sliding the tires down the road, barely moving, risking the fact that someone hits him and someone gets killed. So he makes a reasonable decision and says, okay, I'm not going to freeze to death, and I'm not going to try not to kill someone else. So he unhooks his trailer from the cab of his truck. He drives down the road until he finds a place that he can get in and warm up. He stops. He gets in. He warms up. He stays just long enough to warm up. He gets back in the cab of his truck, drives back to where he left the trailer, off the road, not in the road, pulls back in. The mechanic's there. They fix the trailer brakes, get the trailer brakes loosened up. He goes on and makes his deliveries. This company fires him. And Gorsuch then ruled that the company had every right to fire him.
Hear the whole story on the Leslie Marshall Show, Monday to Friday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific, on the Progressive Voices Network.